This interview with Carol Backhaus of UCLA was recorded in November 2008.
Okay, Carol Backhaus, I teach at UCLA. I'm in the Department of Near Eastern Languages and Cultures. I teach undergrad courses related to the study of religion. One particular popular course is The Origins of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. And the other course is the Introduction to Judaism. I also teach an undergrad course on scriptural interpretation, holy text, holy other, W-H-O-L-L-Y. And on the graduate level, I teach a course on theory and methods in the study of religion, and courses in Midrash and rabbinic literature.
And what type of student do you have? It's a state school, right?
Yeah, we have students who are first generation college attendees. We have serious graduate students. We have an ethnically diverse population. A population, furthermore, that is also religiously diversified.
And do you consider yourself a Bible scholar, or do you
consider
yourself more of a religious studies person?
Religious studies person, I consider myself a student of scriptural studies, because I'm also interested in the Quran, and one has to be careful not to conflate the two, Bible and Quran. But often when you talk about Islamic interpretations of biblical figures, the assumption is that these figures such as Noah and Moses, who are in the Quran, are only in the Bible. So it's complicated in that respect. You know, I will say that I'm, just for full disclosure, that I'm not Jewish, and I'm in the field of Jewish studies. And that's not as common. So
did you study ancient languages?
I started at the master's level with biblical Hebrew. And then when I did the graduate work, did modern Hebrew and Aramaic. And I do Arabic as well.
What is it that you do? How do you spend your time on a day-to-day basis?
To give an example, an article I'm working on now is on the interpretations of the flood narrative in the three traditions, and in particular how they address the question of the destruction of the animals. So I spend my day reading. First, not today, because I've already read the biblical account and read the Quranic account.
In the original, sorry?
Yes, of course. Always in the original, yeah. And that's very, very important. And then I go to the interpretive sources. A look at Philo, for example, an ancient first century Jewish thinker, exegete, philosopher. So I'll read various ancient sources to see to what extent they deal with the question, this question I'm working on, the death of the animals. And I'll also look at the New Testament to see if there's any reference to it there. I'll go through the rabbinic texts, and then I'll turn to the Islamic sources, the Tafsir and the Qisas al-Anbiya, the stories of the prophets, to see if they've dealt with these this particular question. And then you collect your sources and reflect on them. And you might well imagine that one of the problems is what sources do you leave out? You know, where do you stop? Do you stop at the medieval period? Do you go into the modern period? Modern scholars and exegetes, theologians must deal with the question of the death of the animals. Is God just? Is it collateral damage too high? Why were they destroyed? Did they sin? If so, what sin did they commit? But by the way, that question is not a question the pre-moderns would ask, because they didn't see, first of all, that the animals were capable of sinning. It's a category that's not applicable to them. But furthermore, they understand animals as subject to humans. If humans were destroyed, then what use would the animals have? So I'm not only broadening the story within one tradition, I'm broadening the story as it has been interpreted in the three traditions. Because I think it's very important as we read the biblical and the Quranic story to ask, well, how has it been understood? In fact, the way we read the story often isn't by reading it directly, but rather through the lens of previous exegetes. For example, Augustine, to read the story of Adam and Eve as the story of original sin. It's, for Christians, it's inseparable, frankly, for many anyway, to see it in any other way, or to read it as sex, that the sin they committed was sex, or that they sinned by eating an apple. There's no apple. It's a pre-hagafen. This is the fruit, not apple. So that's a good example, I think, of the role that interpretation plays in forming how we understand the Bible. My question is question of transmission of stories, of traditions. It's a historical question.
So you are interested in those interpretations. You don't see them as clouding the actual text.
But when you're doing the history of interpretation, you move to the next step. How did the ancients come to understand the questions, these thorny questions? What are the cultural contours that shape their understanding of a biblical passage? What are the burning issues of the day for a particular interpreter? Are those issues the same issues we have? I mean, just case in point, I mentioned the animals. By asking, why did God punish the animals? I was asking the wrong question. That's not the question that the pre-modern interpretive tradition was asking. They were asking, why did God destroy his creation? Because, and the difference is the following. I'm a vegetarian, very sensitive to animals, and I read the story and said, but this is not fair. Why, what did they do? The flood is God's punishment for the evil ways of the people. He regretted that he had made them. They were sinful, and he was going to destroy them with the flood. But he also destroyed animals. Why? That's not fair. That's not the question that pre-modern interpreters understand, because they don't see the world that way. They see the world hierarchically ordered. Animals are subjects subservient to humans. Humans are subservient to God. All creation is subservient to God. If you, according to Philo, he uses the analogy, if you cut the head off, the body is no longer of use. So too, if humans are destroyed, what use are the animals? I found this really striking. So showing those differences isn't just about the Bible, but it's about understanding how we are in the world, how we read, and how our being in the world shapes the way we read and the questions we ask. And it also is an opportunity to appreciate how pre-moderns lived in the world and were shaped by their cultural context.
And what did you get out of studying the Quran story there?
The Quran interpreters were very silent with regard to this question. I have yet to come across a tafsirist, an interpreter of the Quran, who deals explicitly with the question. There's one exegete, Muqatil ibn Suleiman, who mentions that God made women barren for 40 years prior to the flood, in a way anticipating a possible indictment of God for killing innocent children. But there was no mention of the animals. And so why weren't they mentioned? But if you look at the Quran in numerous passages refers to the subservience of animals to humans. In fact, in one passage, God says that I have subjected creation for humans.
Interesting about your process of questions and then letting what you read reform your questions.
Yeah. I know, but I think that's very important. You can't come to the text with a preconceived notion of the text or a question to which you already have the answers. That's not what we do. We experience the text, and the text unfolds, and the text has many levels to it, and it's a constant engagement. How often have I read the Noah story? And yet, every time I come back to it, I see something new, something different, something pleasant, something disturbing. Every new conversation I have with students is a new experience of the text.
Mm-hmm. Is there a received wisdom about the Bible? Is there another thing that you think you know, but that is not common knowledge to people who think they know the Bible?
I can't think of a particular story. What I think is very important, very, very important, is that we recognize that the Old Testament and the Hebrew Bible are the same and different. The Old Testament is the first part of the Christian Bible. The Old Testament is not deemed the canonical scriptures of the Jewish people. For the Jews, the equivalent is the Tanakh or the Hebrew scriptures. And I say that because they have a different ordering, and the ordering tells us something about how each community understands itself, for one thing. And the Old Testament implies that there is something new. Whereas for the Jews, the Tanakh or Hebrew scriptures is the living Bible. And when we use the terms of one tradition for another, we are not fully understanding the other. I really emphasize this in my classes. I think it's really important that in the context of the study of Judaism, we use the language of the tradition. And in this case, it's Hebrew scriptures or Tanakh, and not Old Testament. Old Testament has a Christian understanding of this body of texts.
Yeah, it sounds like for you, the Bible, it's not just about studying it historically, either in terms of the history of interpretation of the text, but that there are questions of meaning that can resonate.
Absolutely. I can't honestly say that all the stories of the Bible are equally compelling. But there is a reason we keep going back to, for example, Cain and Abel. It says something about the human condition. Whenever I hear about my friend's two sons who are competitive, I can't help but think of the Cain and Abel story. And in fact, I wonder to what extent, you know, did God provoke Cain when he preferred Abel's offering? That element of jealousy, that human feeling of disappointment when you're rejected in some way, that the preference is for the other, even though you may feel equally loved as a child, right? Or as a teacher, or as a friend. But that one is preferred for whatever reason. I think that that story gets to that, and it allows us to explore the issue of jealousy. I think of Sarah and Hagar when Sarah said, "Oh sure, take Hagar, and I will become a mother through her," basically. Well, that didn't work out so well, now did it? What does it feel like for a woman, for a barren woman, to know that that she can't give her husband a child? And says, "Well, we can have a surrogate." What kind of relationship does she have with the other woman? How many of us are above those raw emotions of feeling inadequate and jealous?
So let's just end with, for you, what are the rewards? I mean, what do you mm-hmm. enjoy about the work that you do?
I think I'm most excited when I recognize that moment of recognition in my students, or that aha, or oh, I didn't know that. We assume we know the Bible. If you ask your students, what's in the Bible, what God wants us to do and not do? Well, yes, but not quite. Or they assume they know the stories. And by introducing them to the stories of the Bible and the layers to the stories, the different questions we can ask, the historical questions, the literary questions, and also the moral questions. That's what excites me when I make the Bible come alive, or we in the classroom make it come alive together, so that even for someone who is not a believer, or is not a member of a religious community, nonetheless has a deep appreciation for the meaningfulness of the Bible, that there is a reason it is one of the cornerstones of our civilization, that it's not a book that you find in your hotel room, or a book that others read. Those others who are religious, right? That negative connotation, in fact, well, only religious people read the Bible, and that's actually not a good thing, because I'm not religious, and it's for those people. But it's for all of us. It's for all of us. When I hear back from students that this is a good book, as troubling as it is, because the texts of terror that we find in the Bible are challenging. You know, I wonder for a non-scholar of the Bible, I wonder if a question would be, gee, you've read it once, isn't that enough? Or how many years you need to devote to understanding? But it is one book. Well, even though it's several books, you can't probe the depths of the work, because it's not reading a book, it's reading a life. It's an engagement with a life